Well, hello and welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducciu. And I believe this week I get to kick things off. Isn't that right, Greg?
I think that's fair enough, yeah.
Yes. Okay, so, well, I think the reason why I get it this way is because we talk a fair bit about my Turkish heritage, but my mother is American. And today, yee-haw, we be talking about cowboys.
And I know that people love your accents, Jem, so great to start off the episode as we mean to go. Now, when we start talking about cowboys, Jem, you introduced the subject to me because, I mean, I did a quick Google on cowboys to try and get my background information, and the first thing that came up was the Dallas Cowboys, the American football team. So I've got a feeling that my research will be slightly wrong because it's all just talking about... But in all seriousness, when we talk about cowboys, I think we kind of have two different things going on. One is the historical, the actual cowboys, as in the people who are out... tending the cattle, as it were. And the flip side of that is we kind of conflate that with the entire history of the American West, the gunfighters, your tombstones, your Wyatt Earps, things like that. Now, which road are we going down today?
Let's do a bit of both. But I would, everything you just said, yes, I agree. You're absolutely right. And what I would actually do as a comparison, I've heard a couple of people talk about it this way, is saying the way in Europe we talk about knights, chivalry was a real thing. Men clad in plate armor was a real thing. But the image we have of them today is not really very historically accurate. And there's a lot of legend and retelling of stories that has turned knights into what pops into your mind right now. It's actually the same thing with samurai. There really were samurai, but they evolved quite a lot over the centuries, and really most of what we know today was written by a Japanese immigrant into America around about 1900-ish, and it was his view of samurai is what we all tend to think of as samurai today. And it's the same thing with cowboys. Yes, there were guys with six-shooter guns in the 1880s who would drive cattle across America, but it was a very short period of time, and as you said, it suddenly gets turned into gunfighters and sheriffs and all these other things. These were real people, real things that did happen in the Wild West, in inverted commas, on the Great Frontier. But it's actually very hard to find real cowboys for any amount of time that are anything like what you have in your mind right now.
Okay, so what era, let's start at the very beginning. What era are we actually talking about? Because obviously we've got to be talking about, you know, post the settling of America, and you've got the cattle over there. Now, the thing is, when we think cowboys, we sort of conflate that in our minds, or I certainly do, with Victorian times. You've got to have your horses, you've got to have your stagecoaches, you've got to have your six shooters and everything else. But the same as when you're talking about knights, and you know, as we're going to make that comparison, when we start talking about knights, it very quickly gets complicated by, well, okay, when we talk about knights, at what point do we start the reference to knights? Is it going to be in the medieval times? Is it going to be, you know, sort of Tudor knights? Are we talking about the Crusades? Are those the knights we're talking about? Are we accepting sort of the Saxon knights? Are we accepting the Battle of Hastings? Are we going to go far enough back to, obviously, there were soldiers on horseback as far back as the Romans? You know, and then you get this, and I think we're going to have the same problem when we start talking about cowboys. At what sort of point can we allow that era to sort of begin to be called the real cowboys?
Well, look, what you've just said is absolutely true, and if you like, that's the problem with this history. It's why it's an interesting conversation. When you say cowboy, you tend to think American, but you know what? Guys on horses that are moving cattle around, well, that happened in medieval Europe. The very first cowboys in America were Spanish. I think their names were vaqueros. I'm probably butchering that word. Apologies to anybody who knows the correct pronunciation of that. So when we say cowboy, we mean a rather specific thing, and that tends to be after the American Civil War, and it tends to be at the period where there was mass movement of people, materials, horses, cows across America as the states grew and the railways were laid, etc. The linking up. We're going to put an iron belt across America was the idea of the transnational railway lines, and in a way that was sort of linked to the cowboys. Just one last thing I'll say on this point is you mentioned Victorian, and do you know what? It took me years as a child. When you're a kid, you tend to think that all these different people and eras lived in very different times, and it's hard to work out that there is overlaps. And it took me a long time to work out, do you know what, when you got all those big mutton chops and Disraeli and things like Zulu, that was what was happening in Britain at exactly the same time as the cowboy stuff was happening in America. And it is a reminder, because it's so mythical, because they're so brave, because they're at the kings of the wild frontier, blah, blah, blah. It is myth-making in America, and there's nothing wrong with that. Every country has like a mythical, heroic figure. But it does show you how far behind America was to Europe. And it is a sign that the 20th century really was the time America came onto the scene. But quite frankly, in the 1880s, there were far more people living in agrarian societies, in cowboy-type frontier towns, as opposed to the industrial epicenters of places like Birmingham and Manchester and London. And, you know, if you wanted to do... if you wanted to have great science, great learning, you would go to Europe. You certainly wouldn't be going to the middle of America, because largely it was full of buffalo. I feel I've gone on a little bit of a bit there. Over to you, Greg.
Well, actually, one of the things that immediately sprung up in my mind, and it's kind of taken a tangent to your point there, is when you talk about how America and Britain, how much more advanced almost things seem in Britain during the sort of Victorian times. It seems much more civilized. It seems much more refined. And making that comparison kind of got me thinking about a comparison, got me thinking about something about the history of both countries, and that is the Civil War. Because taking us away from the cattle-driving cowboys just for a moment and into the realm of, you know, sort of these cowboys who go around with their six shooters and, you know, the Western idea of a cowboy, a Western being, you know, sort of the TV film genre, you know, sort of going into a town and shooting it up and bank robbers and all of that. And one of the interesting things that I think links there is the American Civil War, because one of the things about the English Civil War, one of the unexpected consequences of English Civil War, and this is a topic completely for another time.
Yeah, I really feel we're going off piece here, but off you go.
Is, well, the British Civil War, following the end of the British Civil War, we actually had a new style. That is where we get our romantic impression of the highwayman from, following the English Civil War. Because at the end of the English Civil War, you had a lot of, you know, sort of better class, higher class people who were dressed in that sort of way, who suddenly found themselves on the losing side of a major conflict, and suddenly found themselves within their own country, outlaws, lost land, lost things like that. And I think there's a potential that we got to look at the fact that after the American Civil War, you know, obviously it's a couple of hundred years later, so technology and everything moves on, but the American Civil War ends you up in the same position where you've got a lot of people who suddenly find themselves outcasts on the wrong side in their own country. And when you watch a lot of Westerns, you do find that is a running theme. You know, it is a running theme that it is overhang of the Civil War carrying on, and that's where a lot of the violence spurs from. And it is one of these things where that country went through this violent period and people were fighting friends, neighbours. And I think from that you get the growth of, one, well, yeah, cowboys, they were hardy people. They are the sort of people that would have got involved with the fighting and things like that anyway. But also once it's over, a lot of people who found themselves on the wrong side then turn to criminal means to make money. And that is sort of where we then move into the bank robbers and all of this and all of the Wild West side of cowboys. I think that way there's a link and kind of explains why this would be happening later in America than it was in Britain, why you would still have this roughness, this violence, because they are immediately around the time of a civil war. Or I could just be rambling, I'll be honest with you.
Well, no, I take your point. And if you like, the big difference between something like the knights and the cowboys is the knights, even in the legendary version of them, they're very much in the center of society, whereas the cowboys are those frontiersmen, as you said, sort of like the outlaws, literally outside of the law, because they're outside of the country of America. You know, there's big areas which are referred to as territories. They're not actually states yet. But that period was actually surprisingly brief. You would never find an old man who'd been a cowboy for 40 years because the period had finished. It's a bit like the Pony Express, where there'd be a bunch of relays across America where people would gallop hard to the next station, pick up a new horse, gallop hard again to the next station, and you could get mail across the country, you know, suddenly rather within weeks than you know, within days. And actually, the Mongols did something like that similarly in the 13th century. But anyway, the Pony Express is another legendary thing that happened at the same time as the cowboys. Good news, no guns, no outlaws. This is just the coolest form of postman you'll ever get. It lasted barely 20 years because very quickly we had railroads, we had telegraph lines, and if you needed to get a message quickly, yeah, sorry Pony Express, you are surprisingly slow as Victorian technology completely outstripped it. It's a very short period of time. Exactly what you mean by cowboy can absolutely change. And it certainly doesn't have to be in America even. You know, there are moving cows around all over the place and people go on horseback for all kinds of reasons. There are loads in New Zealand and Australia roughly the same time. Cows just didn't kind of suit the land so much, so they moved around sheep. But they were still on horses. They still sometimes had guns to protect from predators and possibly bandits and rustling, sheep rustling, but it doesn't sound as cool, sheep boy. And indeed, shepherd is what we would tend to call them, a mounted shepherd, whereas cowboy is shepherd for cows, really. But it sounds a lot cooler, doesn't it?
It does indeed. And I think one of the interesting things that I picked up while you were talking there was, you say this is a really, really short period and there's nobody that grew old as a cowboy. And that's right, and I think that's actually part of where this legend comes from, is the timing of it, and as you mentioned, the movement of Victorian technology, the continuation, the continual rise of Victorian technology, because I want to take one particular famous, sheriff, actually. You know, we're in a Western time, we have sheriffs.
Is this Wyatt Earp, by any chance?
Wyatt Earp, of course it is. Yeah, Wyatt Earp. Famous, of course, for taking part in the gunfight at the OK Corral, Tombstone, possibly, arguably, one of the most famous real-life shootouts in the Wild West. And let's be very, very clear here. When we're talking about a shootout, when you watch a Western on your telly and they have the shootout and you've got John Wayne there and they have the shootout, and the shootout is basically the last half of the film.
Yeah, yes, you know, yes. I thought you
might
say this.
The villain arrives and you have this huge fight and people hiding behind things and diving out and shooting at each other. I believe the gunfight in Tombstone was supposed to have lasted about 30 seconds, as
most
gunfights
it was
did. You know,
if, less than a minute.
Yeah, if people meet on the street with guns, it does not last half an hour while everybody hides in their house. You know, it is quick, it is sharp, it is over and it's done. And, you know, Hollywood's kind of taken that. But what I want to talk about, particularly with Earp, as we talk about spanning of history, was he was born in 1848. He was born before the Civil War. He rose up to be this lawman. He had this massive gunfight at the OK Corral. But he carried on living until 1929. He lived well into the 20th century, and he lived long enough for the films to start being made. And he actually got involved in Hollywood. He actually got involved, and he was actually portrayed on film before his own death. So when we're talking about the knights becoming history and becoming legend, when we're talking about the cowboys, cowboys are one of the most famous sheriffs of the Western time, lived long enough to be involved in Hollywood and to see his life put on the screen and to be instrumental in helping shape the way their stories went on screen. So when we look at the Western genre and we look at the way cowboys are portrayed now, and really it's because of that big filmmaking movement as well as the books, it's interesting to note that because it was such a short time, those actual people involved, you know, it's like, I don't know, I suppose the only equivalent from the Crusades and things is the fact that they got a lot of the kings and that got involved in having people write their histories, record their histories for them.
Well, but actually, there is one analogy. I agree, it's far more powerful in the cowboy era. But the one analogy is the tale of King Arthur, the Mort d'Arthur, Geoffrey of Monmouth, I want to say. Is it Geoffrey or Henry? I can't remember. It's definitely Monmouth.
Geoffrey, I believe.
Yeah, Geoffrey of Monmouth. And he was writing, of course, he was writing in theory about something that was happening maybe 500 years earlier, but he was writing this at the period where there genuinely were knights. And we do know that it was referenced. It was hugely popular as a story, and it clearly influenced. There were knights who read it who thought, that must be the way I must behave. So it had an impact, but it's peanuts compared to, as you just said, films. You know, we mentioned this during the silent one we did recently. It may not be the first, but certainly one of the first proper movies, as in there's a story rather than just sort of set scenes and that's it. You know, there's beginning, middle, and end to it, is The Great Train Robbery, which is a bunch of cowboy bandits stealing money from a train. And its very last scene is rather famously a cowboy pointing his gun out at you, the viewer, and firing his gun off a whole bunch of times. It's, it's a very cool shot, which actually was homaged, just a little side point, was actually homaged with Joe Pesci doing it at the end of Goodfellas. So it's a sort of Martin Scorsese showing, proving once again he knows his history of cinema. But anyway, the point is, yeah, there were some of these people who were very obvious in terms of, I am going to create my own myth, my own story. For example, Buffalo Bill is probably the most famous one of those, where, you know, the big Buffalo Bill show, he did do some things as a young man, but he was one of the creators of this Wild West myth because it made him money. And he'd actually get authentic Native Americans onto his big show, and people could recreate sort of things like the, Battle of Little Bighorn and all this kind of stuff. But it was absolutely entertainment. It was not historical reenactment by any stretch of the imagination.
That's true. And what I really enjoy about it is we're getting to the crux of why this mythology built up and everything else. But one of the other sides to that is the other mention that you made of it being quite a short-lived thing is, of course, that when these cowboys, they rode horses, they got the cattle, suddenly cars start coming in and other vehicles, tractors and things start coming in. And so the other thing with the early age of film, the other reason why we suddenly find all these cowboy movies springing up is because where they wanted to film was where there was wide open land. They went over to Hollywood, to California. And the other thing, of course, is suddenly you've got a fair amount of cowboys who are then looking for work. They're actually looking for, you know, they're slowly losing their jobs as cowboys. And suddenly there's this movie industry that wants a lot of action. If they can employ a load of people who are great on horses and they can put on films with a lot of horse chases and horse sequences, that gives them immediate action. You've got your Buffalo Bill Wild West show. And one thing that rises out of the original cowboys and is still hugely, hugely popular in America today, although it's one of those things hugely popular in America, we don't have it at all over here, is, of course, the idea of the rodeo. And yeah, it's interesting that it's the fact that cowboys became this idea of entertainment. They lived in books, on film, in the rodeos, in the Wild West shows, in all of these different ways. And that has kind of taken essentially a farmhand, you know, somebody who works on a farm. You know, they do herd them long distances, they do the ranch, and they do this. But essentially, it's like building a mythos around, you know, somebody who drives a tractor or anything else. It's the mythos and this whole entertainment industry that's been going on, you know, way back from the beginning, the early rodeos, the early competitions, cattle shows and things like that. That's built up into another huge industry. And that is really based, the rodeos are based not around the fiction idea of the cowboy or any wider context where they're gunfights or anything else. That is just turning the skill of horse riding and, you know, sort of roping and all of these things and turning those in themselves into a major sport.
Yeah, did you know what? Until you said that, I'd completely forgotten that side of it. But full disclosure, earlier this year, I was in Houston, Texas, and I'm actually going back there again early next year. And, you know, you can't escape posters for things like the rodeo or, you know, bull riding, which is really dangerous. You know, you people may sort of like go onto the wild horses and they thrash around and then you get onto a full bull. You know, that's sort of close to a ton of angry meat that you're going to have to sort of hang on to. All of this is obviously a heightened reality. There was a necessity to breaking horses back in the 1880s. It's not necessary at all now, but you know, you can fill an auditorium with people. You can fill an auditorium with people running around and, you know, lassoing things. And yeah, and do you know what? Those sorts of places, they might well be doing that on the weekend, but during the week, they might well do medieval banquets. And none of it is historically accurate, but all of it is fun. And there is just an element of coolness and romance to it all. And I think I've been very good at avoiding any of the violence, but I'm going to have to say one thing, because if I don't mention this, we haven't done a proper podcast about the cowboys. But during the American Civil War, that was probably one of the last wars where men lined up and fired guns, and it took them a while to reload their rifles. Now, yes, there'd been innovations. It was percussion cap rather than flintlock, and let's not go down that route. But the point is, line up in a row, everybody fires, and it takes us maybe 30 seconds to reload the gun. And therefore, if you had a revolver, that was extraordinarily useful and powerful at short range in that scenario. And that was an era where the Smith & Wesson, there you go, famous Smith & Wesson gun manufacturers did create a six-shooter gun for the American Civil War. It was brilliantly called the Smith & Wesson Model Number 2. They need to work on some advertising there, but that was the 1860s and early 1870s. And then what was interesting is another famous gun manufacturer called Colt didn't want to pay Smith & Wesson any money in terms of using their patent on their six-shooter, so they created their own six-shooter, which came out in 1873. So if you ever see anybody in a American Civil War movie and they've got a Colt revolver, yeah, that's wrong. That's wrong by nearly a decade. But this is the Colt Peacemaker, and its nickname is the Gun That Made America. And this is your standard cowboy gun. They were hugely popular. They became a standard American military sidearm as well into the 1890s. And all you have to do is Google a picture of it and you go, yep, that's a revolver. I recognize that. But the interesting thing is, if you see the movies, they've got these sort of cool belts with bullets on them. And, you know, there's the classic thing of the holster sort of strapped to their leg and it's all ready for like shooting. But if you ever look at old photos of real cowboys, real frontiersmen, that gun is there, but it's kind of strapped to their belt. It is a tool like a pair of pliers. It is not ready to be, you know, fired at in a sort of quick draw, you know, 12 high noon, 12 o'clock shootout, the kind of thing. It's a gun that you'll probably need to use if a cow is injured, you need to put it down, or if you're attacked by wolves. You don't have to worry about gunfights, is the reality of the Wild West.
And I think we're just about running out of time and we're going to have to leave it there in just a few moments. One more thing I wanted to come back to that's not related to cowboys is a little while ago you mentioned King Arthur and Monmouth, and you were slightly struggling to recall the name of the person. And what I want to just mention, Jeremy, is a few weeks ago now on a podcast, we were talking about the history of comedy.
Yeah,
I was talking about as part of that. I was talking about the seven dirty words, one of the comedy routines that I was talking about. And all I wanted to say was that I actually had a tweet from Aaron to remind me. It was, of course, the wonderful George Carlin who actually wrote that piece. And all I wanted to say at this point in time, because you had a please. First of all, thank you to Aaron for just jogging my memory on that after the episode comes out. But if we do forget stuff, if we miss bits like that on air, if we mistake a name, anything like that, please do tweet us and correct us. Let us know, remind us of the things we've forgotten. We don't always get around to correcting them. And then we can correct them or bring them up again in a later podcast. So thank you, Aaron, and thank you to everyone who gets in touch with us. But, Jem, we're moving towards out of time.
I have one last fact I need to put in here, which again links sort of Britain with America, is, again, if you look at those photos of real frontiersmen, if I say, what does a cowboy wear on his head? You're thinking 10-gallon hat, that big broad-brimmed hat. And they did exist, and they were very good at keeping the sun off your head. But they weren't very good at riding. Occasionally, you might fall from a horse, in which case you want a relatively hard hat. In which case, that explains why, in America, I believe the derby is what we call in Britain the bowler hat. And in Britain, the bowler hat, but in both cases, they were primarily riding hats. But because if you were rich enough to have a horse in Britain, you probably had a fairly rich job. And it became associated with bankers and businessmen and the city and financial trading in Britain. And it was something that was worn probably up until the 1950s in the UK. But in America, it's weird from a British perspective seeing cowboys wearing, hang on, that's a British hat. I don't actually know which country invented it, but the point is it's a riding hat and therefore it makes complete sense for a cowboy to wear it. And also, that goes back to, why do Laurel and Hardy wear these sort of fancy schmancy hats? Well, what it's a shorthand for, quite often they're wearing sort of tradesman's dungarees, and they're wearing, Oliver Hardy's little moustache, you might be thinking, oh, that's a bit like Hitler. Yes, but that was very much a working class man's moustache. But the reason why both of them wearing those hats is, again, it's sort of saying that these are odd jobsmen. They can kind of do a bit of anything, and therefore they're working class, they're on your side, the viewer. So it's a visual clue to let them know, yeah, they're on your side. But the derby in America, bowler hat, is one and the same hat. One place it's about finance, another place it's about cowboys.
And do you know what? I'm actually going to leap in with a little bit more information about the bowler hat while we've suddenly gone
all right,
that topic.
All right.
I believe it was British. I believe it was made late 1840s in Britain, and it was made as riding headgear for the British as well. And there used to be a thing about, I believe it was, they would demonstrate it by stamping on the hat and proving a proper old-fashioned bowler hat was actually designed to, like a riding hat today. It was to stop low-hanging branches from damaging your head if you hit something while you were riding. They are actually, although a lot of them today, you see them today, a lot of them are actually quite soft material. A proper bowler hat should be actually able to protect your head, which again is why it was then used by horse riders, the cowboys over in America. It is actually supposed to be protective headgear.
Yes. There we go. Cowboys, everybody. I think we've just
done
them.
There we go. We've done a whole topic of cowboys and we've ended on the history of the bowler hat. So
it's legitimate. Jem, it's legitimate.
At this point in time, Jem, just before we wrap up, do you have a little plug for us at all?
I think I'm going to have to go back to my favourite one at the moment. I have written a total of 8 history books, but the one that I want to talk about is my very first historical novel, Silent Crossroads. It's the story of Harry Woods, the only British soldier that fought in both World Wars on both sides. I've recently had a few more, like 4 and 5 star reviews come up on Amazon. Thank you very much for that. Getting great, great feedback. If you haven't got it yet, it is self-published. You need to go onto Amazon for it, but you can either download it as an ebook for like less than £2, less than $2, or you can buy a paperback, which is about sort of £8.50, $9, something like that. But yeah, good one if you've got a historian in your life that you need to get a Christmas present for. That's me done, Greg.
Okay, and I'm going to plug, as I'm going to be for over the next few weeks, I'm going to say go to www.thelastairship.com, where The Last Airship, Jem's done his first fictional historical book. I've done my first fictional web series. You can always go to www.thelastairship.com. That will take you straight to the first episode of the web series. And they're coming out one a week for 6 weeks leading right up to the start of January. So please, please, please take 6 minutes of your life and go and watch the first episode of that. And thank you again to everybody who listens to the podcast. Please make sure, above us promoting our own projects, we love to promote this podcast. So please share this around. And please, as I mentioned already, as I've mentioned a few times, get in touch. It's at Condensed Hist or at History Gems on Twitter. And please tweet us. And don't feel, you know, you can't tweet us to correct something or to fill in a bit of information. We enjoy making these podcasts. A lot of what we talk about on these podcasts is ideas that we're throwing about. We're coming up with ideas. We're bouncing off of each other. If we get something wrong, let us know. It also lets us know that there are people out there listening as well. So thank you to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Jem Deduccia.
And thank you to my wonderful co-host, Greg Chapman.
And that's all for us today. So goodbye and take care.